Welcome, everybody, to The Local Hour. As you know, here on The Local Hour, we speak to David Samson once a week, host of Nothing Personal with David Samson. I implore you to check out that podcast. David's still going to be a part of this show after January 4th as we deliver to our audience the content they know and love. Maybe in my case, have a slight disdain for it, but either way, we're going to continue on. David, there are so many things to ask you about a lot of sports business news out there. The leading story for the last few days on SportsCenter has been Giannis Antetokounmpo re-signing, and I kind of caught some shit. You know, I'm a big Heat homer, and obviously Heat fans wanted Giannis Antetokounmpo replicate the formula of stealing LeBron James from a smaller market team. Even though Cleveland wasn't a smaller market than Miami, it's weird how they do that. Giannis re-signs. And everyone's like, well, he's there for the long haul now. I kind of the next day had to take, like, I always sort of assumed this would be the case. This seems to be the new way of doing things. Once LeBron decided, hey, no more pay cuts, everyone's taking that extension. And when they want to leave, they just make a stink like you're seeing out of James Harden right now, who 2 years removed from signing the extension is wielding his player power. Number one, what is your takeaway from Giannis's decision to re-sign with Milwaukee? Is this all just confetti fireworks and lovey-dovey, get your season tickets in now, he's here for life? Or is it, hey, let's just wait and see how this plays out?
So I'm just curious, as a Heat fan, did you actually think that he was coming to the Heat? Like, is it the Pat Riley mystique that he was going to find a way to fly to Milwaukee, General Mitchell Field, get in his chauffeur-driven Chevy Suburban, get to Giannis's house and say, Giannis, come to South Beach? Like, did you think that that was happening?
I was holding out hope that Giannis wouldn't sign the extension, because at that point, you know, he is gone. He is gone. But I always kind of assumed if Giannis were to end up in a Miami Heat uniform, it would be in a trade, not in a free agent signing. It's just with the unsettled world market, people are locking in these extensions. And if they want to leave, both teams will make it happen.
Well, were you aware that the Heat could only offer him about $83 million fewer dollars than the Bucks? I mean, I'm just curious whether or not that enters into the equation.
Absolutely.
Of the fan.
Absolutely, which is why I always assumed he was going to sign that extension, and then we'll see what sort of postseason frustration he has. And if so, you have a piece in Tyler Hero who's from that area. Go ahead.
Okay, so the Bucks trading Giannis for a package that includes Tyler Hero is never going to happen. So let's just make sure that we're very clear on that.
All right, so you think he's in Milwaukee for life now?
Absolutely not. Hold on. Those are two totally different things. What I said is that people tend, and I was such a victim of this, Mikey, it's the worst quality to ever have. Falling in love with your own guys is one of the great minefields of running a sports team. And the reason that you fall in love with your own players is you're with them every day and you see what they can be. You see what they are. You see them in their best moments. You ignore their worst moments. And you just assume that every other team values your players the way you do. So what we would like to do is bring in scouts from other teams, right? You poach scouts and development people and they come over and you say, hey, what do you guys got on our 10 guys here? And they say, well, this guy stinks. There's no way that this guy has a chance. We wanted to trade for that guy, but we were only willing to give you a double A prospect. So they would go down the list and we'd say, wow, we totally had it evaluated incorrectly. So I think that you're doing that a little bit with Tyler Hero. He's 20 years old or 21. He had an unbelievable postseason run. He's the local Milwaukee kid. I totally get what you're saying. He's sort of like the anti-Miami glitz. I can't picture him out at 11 until 6 in the morning.
Oh, man, I think you and I are reading Tyler Hero, because I absolutely can. And following him from Instagram, I think he's embraced Miami with wide open arms.
So do you think that as a basketball player, if you were running the Bucks and Giannis pulls a Harden, where Giannis says, you know what, I'm tired of Milwaukee. I've been to every bar now. My family's sick of it. The weather stinks. I want to go to Miami. You call up Pat Riley and say, hey, let's talk about Giannis, and we're going to need Tyler Hero back. Like, is that how you see that happening?
Well, they're going to also need money, contracts that are not as favorable as Tyler Hero's back, because that's how the NBA works. But listen, Dave, Tyler Hero is one of the more valuable assets in that sport right now on a rookie deal. You have a proven scorer, someone that did it in the playoffs as well. For me, the question is, I'd do that deal in a heartbeat, right? The Tyler Hero for Milwaukee. And I think it actually makes a lot of business sense too, being that he's a hometown kid for the Milwaukee Bucks. But that's not on the radar right now. What is on the radar for every Heat fan is, do we do this for James Harden? And you're actually an interesting person to discuss this with, because you had a similar situation. You had a team that was in playoff contention, and in baseball, especially in a non-expanded traditional playoff format, if the Marlins got into the playoffs with Manny Ramirez, they could have made some real noise. Manny Ramirez made key contributions to the Dodgers. You had an opportunity to trade for Manny Ramirez, but you had a prospect in then Mike Stanton that you just couldn't part with. I think it's a similar situation to James Harden and Tyler Hero, David.
Well, here's the thing with baseball trades. The prospects are so valuable, and much more so today than they were even 10 years ago, because of the way people realize the analytics that have come into the game, where now front offices say, and by the way, the front offices are full of 28-year-old Ivy League guys, all of whom say, it doesn't matter the name on the back of the uniform, just show me the numbers, and I will tell you unemotionally whether or not that player is worth more to us than the next player. They basically, what analytics is you take a situation and you put a player into that situation, and then you put it through your computer and the algorithm, and you get a result. That's really all it is. And that's how you figure out where to put the defense. That's how you figure out where, how your lineup's going to go. That's all of analytics is, here's what's happening. Here's the pieces of the puzzle we have. Where do we fit them in? When you make a trade in baseball and you trade young for old, or you trade years of control, it's called in baseball. How do you trade a player who has 6 years of control, meaning he can't leave our team? He can demand a trade all he wants, but he cannot leave our team. Do you trade that for a 2-month rental for the chance of getting a ring? And there are many times that you would choose yes to do that. And we have done that. I mean, I have a World Series ring because we traded one of the great first basemen of all time in Adrian Gonzalez before he could ever become a Marlin. And to get a closer, no less, not to get someone as good as Manny Ramirez, although Urbina was good, but not like Manny Ramirez. But the difference between Stanton and between Adrian Gonzalez is, we felt as though that Adrian Gonzalez was not a once in a, we always say this, by the way, one of the great expressions in for baseball executives, once in a generation talent.
Yeah. And there's right. A lot of prospects that you yourself on your watch flamed out that you thought were once in a generation prospects.
Right. It's so ridiculous. Every scout comes to you every year. Which you got to sign this guy. He's once in a generation.
Which is why Tyler Hero's proven track record is massive, massive, and not exactly like analogous to what's going on with Stanton, even though he ended up winning an MVP. You were projecting him, this is a guy that can win MVP, and he actually ended up doing it.
But what is Hero's, and I'm not trying to be an anti-Heat guy because Pat Riley is my hero from an executive standpoint. What exactly has Tyler Hero done? I'm just curious. Well, he had a year, right?
He had a really good rookie campaign. A really good rookie campaign. Well, I think so, especially when you consider when defenses clamp down, when the pressure ramps up, who were you going to in key moments? And you were going to a 20-year-old Tyler Hero who against the Celtics delivered and maybe wasn't as efficient there, but you see exactly where the ceiling can be for this type of player. He needs to improve his decision-making. He needs to improve his defense. But I saw a player in Tyler Hero that I could project out to being an all-star. All right, I made it to an NBA Finals relying on a 20-year-old kid when all sorts of other players were getting injured. Tyler Hero was there. And people don't make the mistake of just remembering what Tyler Hero did inside the bubble. There were plenty of regular season matchups where he was your closer down the stretch. Once you have someone like that, maybe Tyler Hero isn't an MVP. You want to know who else wasn't an MVP? Dwayne Wade. Now, I am not saying Tyler Hero is Dwayne Wade, but you don't have to be a... If you can project somebody out to be an all-star and you have a 12-year gulf like you have with James Harden and Tyler Hero, it gives me pause. Now, if you and I both love Pat Riley, if Pat Riley decides I'm going for it right now with James Harden, who I have my reservations just from a cultural standpoint and from a physique standpoint and a hard-working, tough-nosed, most hated, you know, Heat culture standpoint, if he decides to go with it, Pat Riley has earned that. And I've earned the right to shut up because that guy knows what he's doing a hell of a lot more than me. But there's plenty of reason for pause here, David.
I will bet you a dollar right now, a Mortimer dollar, that the Heat do not trade for James Harden. Because as desperate as Pat Riley is to win another ring and to show that he can retool without a big three, quote unquote. And Pat Riley, I know him. You know him. He's an ego guy. We're all ego guys, and I don't say that in a pejorative way. He would like a championship without LeBron, without Wade, without Shaq, way more than he wanted the championship with him. It's not even close. So if he can get this group to win a championship, that he's done. Like that's it. So he's saying to himself, is James Harden someone who we can bring in and help us win a title? And the problem with James Harden, and Pat Riley will come to this conclusion, he's not a winner. Now, I'm going to get a lot of criticism because he's been to the Western Conference Finals. He's MVP, and he's in the top four of the MVP. He's a great player. He's not a winner. And an article came out yesterday where Russell Westbrook started talking. There's a lot of sort of talk now about what was going on in Houston and the power that the Rockets gave James Harden. And NBA is a star league, and they give power to players left and right. And LeBron, he's got quite a heavy stick. But LeBron uses his stick in a pointed CEO way. Harden uses his stick to go to Vegas. And those are two very different things. When you're running a team and you know you've got a superstar who you've got to give power to, you better make sure it's LeBron and not Harden.
The leaks are interesting coming out of Houston. For the audience that doesn't know, the story that you referenced was Russell Westbrook getting really frustrated because everyone's waiting to start a video session because James Harden is doing God knows what. And Westbrook's like, start the tape without him. And Westbrook and Harden, they have a history. Chris Paul and James Harden had an ugly breakup. Dwight Howard and James Harden had an ugly breakup. It seems as though at every turn, the Houston Rockets organization acquiesces to James Harden, who doesn't exactly have... Let's just say he's not Jimmy Butler in terms of professionalism and hardworking reputation.
Or leadership.
Now it's leaking out that, you know, he's taking private flights to Atlanta and Vegas. His body fluctuates more than mine's, more than Dan's face. This guy's body, I can't get a read on right now. What do you make of what James Harden is doing in terms of using his player power right now as one of the most unstoppable offensive players we've ever seen in the NBA? He's got one of the greatest moves in the history of that game with that step back. He's also an absolute bore to watch.
Is there a chance you were going to say James Patterson by accident?
No.
The writer, I thought you were about to say that, and I was thinking that was very funny. Who's a more famous James?
James Harden, easily. Right.
Oh, I think it's James Patterson.
Wow.
I think way more people know James Patterson. On this show, maybe not. But in the world, if you counted everybody, I think James Patterson is way more famous
than James Harden. Patterson have a candy?
Does James Harden have a candy?
Yes, he does.
But so did Reggie Jackson. Who cares?
I mean, Reggie Jackson's also more famous than James Patterson.
No way. No chance.
Okay, all right. Does James Patterson have a month associated with him?
But the month of October is only associated to people who like baseball.
Mm-mm.
And by the way, I think half your audience does not know that Reggie Jackson's nickname is Mr. October.
We can put it on the poll.
50%.
I think a lot of people are hearing James Patterson for the first part. In fact, I think you made that name up.
No, he's a very famous author.
I'll take your word for it.
Oh, have you literally never heard of James Patterson?
I'm just speaking for our audience here, David.
Oh, sorry. Okay, no. In any case, let's go back. I think you're going to be wrong on that poll. But in any case, James Patterson is way more famous than James Harden. Maybe not more than James Harden. So James Harden's situation is this. He is the reason you're getting these leaks. I've seen superstars like this. I've had them in the clubhouse. Right?
Who?
The Pudge Rodriguez.
There we
right?
go.
He's very similar.
There you go.
Hanley Ramirez is very similar. Mm-hmm. And Hanley Ramirez never had the on-field pedigree that James Harden's had, not even close. But
no.
Hanley Ramirez was a
but he got a sweet
all-star.
He got a sweet necklace from Jeffrey Loria.
He certainly did. But so did D. Gordon, by the way.
Oh.
And you're talking about the D. Gordon necklace. Hanley Ramirez got a he got a necklace. Annabelle Sanchez got a pendant when he hit the no-hitter. Jeffrey got him a big pendant.
Yeah.
A huge
what was the necklace? 342? Was that the average?
It was whatever his batting average was when he won the title.
It wasn't that impressive. Like in previous years, he might have finished like seventh or eighth in batting average. But I mean,
it's pretty good. Hanley was a very good player.
Yeah.
He just had an issue where we created the Hanley monster, mm-hmm. and Jeffrey created more monsters than anyone because he was such a player guy.
Mm-hmm.
And players know they're so smart. They know exactly who to go to. It's sort of, I would talk to Jeffrey and I would talk to other people in the organization and say, these players are kids. And kids know how to use their parents, right? It's like this weird thing that you're born with, that you know if mom says no, you go to dad. If dad says no, you go to mom. There's certain things you go to one or the other to. You know exactly what buttons to press. Somehow players knew immediately what they could get from Jeffrey, and then they went and got it. And they took advantage of that. What James Harden did is he made it very clear to Frittata or Frittata, to Tejada, whatever the name of the casino magnate who owns the Rockets is. And he said, listen, I'll decide when we're practicing. I'll decide when I want to play. I'll decide when their days off, when we spend nights. We had players trying to tell us, and it worked, Mikey. We had players tell us that we want an extra night in LA. We want an extra night in New York. We don't want an extra night in St. Louis. Stanton did a lot of that. And we ended up saying yes to him when it came to that, but only because I traveled with the team and I wanted to be in those cities too. If I were the type that didn't care.
So you were also, you were putting some of this on Jeffrey. You were also doing the player empowerment stuff.
Oh, yes. When it came to travel, right? I was 100% doing that because I wanted to be in certain places, or if I had the ability to get to Vegas with an extra day off in LA between an LA and San Francisco. By the way, that goes back to manipulating the schedule. Oh God, can I just tell you a stupid story?
Please do.
Okay. The way MLB schedule works is that you get a draft of the schedule the year before, sometime in June before the following season. So I would go through the schedule and I would look at opponents and I would say, okay, we want an off day here. We want to move this Wednesday, Thursday game to a Monday so we can have an off day Thursday. If we were traveling back from the West Coast to Miami and had an off day, I would want the off day after the trip so I could stop in Vegas. Stop or stay in California. So I would go through the schedule as a team president. our head of scheduling would be like, why are you so interested in the schedule? And the answer is because I'm planning my own schedule and I'm just the OCD guy to do it because my plans would be done a year in advance. So I would know, by the way, I'm going on this road trip and I've got an extra off day. Chicago, we would ask for the most afternoon games possible so we could go out in Chicago at night. And MLB knew, right? Because there's a call that you do, right? And the call is between teams. And they decide when games are going to be played, et cetera. And all of a sudden, like, Samson chirps up. Oh, yeah, he needs an off day, right, from L.A. It's just funny, right, well, you can do the schedule. So I would sometimes think to myself when players had demands like that, I wouldn't get on them because – as a leader, I wanted to be consistent, and what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Yeah. So I'd only be upset when they'd want like a cryo chamber, which I wouldn't use in my recovery. Yep. So I would blame the players for going over my head to Jeffrey.
You did it in this interview. You put it on Stanton when it's you that wants to stay in Vegas.
He did too, by the way.
Yeah, but he's just convenient. Not just me. Oh, which reminds me, there's something, a friend of mine made this observation last week. And it seems as though it's just like the internal struggle of David Sampson personified, right? When you said the Tampa Bay Rays owner just wants to be liked, you have to go out there and be the asshole to get what you want. And he just doesn't have the guts to be the asshole. Yet, within the very same podcast, you're lamenting the fact that you have to convince people that you're not the asshole. Because of a career in baseball where you're going out not caring about being popular the way that the Tampa Bay Rays owner. I thought it was an astute observation by my friend here. What's your response to that?
So there's a difference between the way I am now and the way I was before. So remember, I was playing a part. And the part I was playing for 18 years was to be the asshole, was to be the heavy. And that was not me personally ever. So what I was describing was the difference between my public persona and my real private persona, and how when people would meet me privately, they would immediately assume that the public persona was. It happened when I walked into CBS. I walked into CBS and everyone was like, I don't know if I even want to talk to this guy, because it was in South Florida. They all knew who I was and they assumed I was going to come in and be a prima donna. And they all came up to me 2 months into my tenure at CBS and said, God, we didn't realize that you'd sit here and just talk to us and be normal. So what I lamented is that the part I played, people confused it with who I really was. And that's never been the case. Now, who I really am is the OCD and the type A and the controlling and the Machiavellian. All of those things are real in terms of business. But Mikey, you're a great example too. We have a totally different relationship off the air than on the air. And what I do on the air is just tell it how it is.
But when you cite specifically the Tampa Bay Rays owner, can he just look at you as a, like a sort of cautionary tale? Because I don't think I want to sign up for a life after whatever it is I need to get done of trying to convince people that I'm truly this nice guy. I don't want to walk the halls of CBS and have to work so hard to win people over. You can certainly understand why someone wouldn't want to sign up for that. No?
No, I don't. Because because you said one thing that's not right. I don't work so hard because I am who I am. I'm not purposely acting, trying to get people to like me once they meet me. I just am who I am, direct and forward and honest. But people, when they meet me, it's just different than when they read about me or in the old days.
But you're not at all frustrated about all these preconceived notions about you built off of what you did in baseball?
I created them. How could I be frustrated by them? I don't understand the question. I would not be able to live with myself if I had no brain synapses which understood why people react to me the way they do. That's like people who claim that Dan is in charge of me, right? And Dan, for his show, got me to say all the things I said over the years. It's a joke. I've manipulated Dan from the beginning about getting him to allowing me to use his audience and use his platform to for me to have fun and for me to get points across when they need to get across.
I've got a handful of questions here because I dispute that you've manipulated me more than I've manipulated you. I believe I've manipulated you more than you've manipulated me. First of all, the Tampa owner did a few interviews. I don't believe he's as liked as you think he is, but when you say my job was to be the asshole, was that a spoken agreement or was it unspoken? Did you actually have conversations? This is our strategy. David's going out there and he's going to be the pinata.
No, that came when it became very clear to me on the first day in Montreal when I realized the role Jeffrey wanted to play. He didn't articulate that early on because when you become an owner of a team, you don't know how you're going to be until you are the owner. It's like Steve Cohen of the Mets, assuming he's going to be this great Twitter guy. He's been in the job for a month. Let's see what happens, you know, when they're 30 and 60 and he's getting 10,000, you know, comments. So no, it grew, Dan. It was not prescribed.
What do you say to people about how the Mets owner has begun his campaign? Like, what can you tell us about the new Mets owner who won the press conference and now what?
Well, he's paying attention to his PR people for now, but there hasn't been a loss. He hasn't experienced a blown save. He hasn't experienced one of the people he signs. He hasn't had James McCann not throw out a runner while going 0-for-4 and having the Mets 7 games behind the Phillies. So we don't know at all. You don't know how you are going to be until you start losing games. And that's how we look at players. You can't judge a player when he's going well. You actually have to look at a player during a slump and when your team stinks.
I want to talk to you a little bit about ownership and Jeffrey Luria and what you're talking about there at the beginning with the Expos. Where and when did you have to learn how to work around his insecurities? Where and when did you have to learn, wait a minute, is this what ownership is? It's meddlesome. It's complicated. It's human. It's his toy. Like, how along the process, where did you learn those things? And I'd like to get into sort of the stories about, I don't believe from what I've seen of Jeffrey Luria and a rich man's lifestyle that he would know how to do some basic things. I feel like you had to do everything. If a carpet needed cleaning in the stadium, I believe that you're the one who had to go and put your fingerprints all over that.
So in I don't know that we've ever talked about this, even off the air. When I was December 9th, 1999, I was the first press conference to announce Jeffrey as owner. And I was sitting in the first row and he was up on the dais and he was up with Stephen Bronfman and other big time Canadian businessmen. And after the press conference, I had to give some interviews because people wanted to talk to me because I was named as executive vice president. I was staying at the Intercontinental Hotel room 2512 and I'd done a contract to live there while I was in Montreal. Wasn't going to buy a house. And articles started coming out that had me quoted. Jeffrey called me the first night because he flew back to New York after the press conference. He called me to tell me this wasn't going to work out. He called me to say that I should probably come to New York and that he didn't want me running the team anymore because he saw my name in the paper and he saw that I was being interviewed and that some reason I was being looked at as someone important in the company. And he told me that I should pack my bags and leave. And I was ready to pack my bags and leave because I had been fired basically the first day before I'd even started. And I got a call from my mother, and they were married at the time. And my mother called me and said, listen, don't pack. He's very emotional right now. He's very upset that you're in the media, that you're getting attention right now. But he also recognizes, he told me, that he's not going to be there running the team and he needs someone to run the team. So why don't you just spend the night in Montreal and we'll see what happens in the morning. And the morning came and I just said to Jeffrey, I said, am I going to the office? Do you want me to fly home? What do you want me to do? And he said, get to the office. And to me, that was the first time I realized that I was going to have to deal with emotion because I didn't want to deal with emotion because it was distracting and it's hard to deal with. And it happened for the next 18 years where there would be moments where he wanted me gone or moments when he didn't want me doing radio shows or moments when he wanted certain deals done.
How many times were you fired? Like how many times did you feel like that's it? That's going to be the end of the run.
In 18 years, probably 8.
And how often would he apologize to you?
I've never gotten an apology. I don't know what you mean by that. Like I'm sorry, David?
Yeah, whatever. He fires fires you 8 times and brings you back. Somewhere in there, there might be the admission of, I'm sorry I got that wrong.
No, because the way it comes back, and again, this doesn't make him different.
Not even with John Buck?
Am I what?
Not even with John Buck did he apologize?
No, because John Buck wasn't his fault.
Yeah. All right, so he blames you guys for his pressure?
What I learned very quickly is that everything that goes right, we had to give him credit, and everything that goes wrong, I was the one who was going to take the blame. And so I eventually, to answer your question, I just became comfortable in that role because I knew that that was my job and I was being paid and I was fine with it because at the end of the day, I didn't care. Again, many of Jeffrey's ideas worked, but when you're involved as an owner, you're going to have 1,000 ideas. You're going to hit 200, right? So 200 of the ideas are really good, and 800 of them we had to work around.
You mentioned that there were probably 8 times where you felt like you were going to get fired. How many times did you want to quit?
Well, you know, I interviewed for other jobs. I mean, I there were many times when I said, that's it. I laid down the gauntlet with him 2 or 3 times during the course of the career where I said, either this guy goes or I go. You make the choice. I did it with a former scout who I did not want to work with and was being absolutely subversive. And I said, it's very simple. Either you fire him or I'm quitting. It's totally up to you. And then I was forced to, he sided with me and I was forced to fire him. And then he got rehired years and years later, actually.
Was Jeff Torborg also one of these when you almost got into a fight with him?
But I didn't know because I didn't. I knew that Philippe Alou was going to be fired. I knew he was going to hire Jeff Torborg. There's certain things that you just knew. Yankee connections and Oklahoma City connections were just going to happen. And so you just sort of embrace it. It was like the Hideki Arabu deal or Joe Girardi or Don Mattingly. By the way, Don Mattingly, we were told we're hiring Don Mattingly. It wasn't even a question. And so we interviewed him, but it was totally perfunctory. It was just so he could meet us. Right. We had met him as manager of the Dodgers and bench coach of the Yankees, but just so we could sit down. We didn't negotiate a deal. I didn't negotiate with Ozzie Guillen. Ozzie Guillen came in and told us what he had agreed to with Jeffrey. John Buck's agent, the Levinsons, told us what we had agreed to. Dustin McGowan's agent, who are the same Levinsons, came in and said, by the way, I was just re-up for another year at $1 million. And we were like, are you kidding me? We don't want
Dustin McGowan.
I can't even talk about it. I can't even talk
Wait
about
a second. Even Buck, I can understand. I can even understand John Buck.
What happened
Dustin
there?
Dustin McGowan.
What happened there?
Dustin McGowan is a nothing reliever, a nice guy. But let me separate guy from talent. A nothing pitcher on the staff who is going to now make about $1 million. And there was no way we were going to pay him $1 million. No way. Because we could have someone do his job likely better for 500 grand. So there's no way we're going to waste 500 grand. And so we were letting him go. All of a sudden, we're in a meeting with Jeffrey, and Jeffrey says, by the way, we're putting the team together. Yeah, let's make sure we have McGowan on the team. We were like, McGowan's not on the team. He said, no, I think we should take a look at that. Why don't you just see what he'd sign for? And we knew when he said that, that means he's already has an agreement with Jeffrey. So we knew the gig. We called up the Levinson brothers and said, all right, what did we sign McGowan for? He said, oh, it's about $1 million plus 215 incentives. And we said, we're not doing that. And Levinson said, it's done. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. You just swallow and you go to Jeffrey and say, all right, you're now going to write a check for $12.4 million instead of, you know, $12.1 million. It's your choice. But by the way, our team is not better because of that.
Do you have a best example outside of the opening press conference where you're feeling his insecurity?
Yes. All times during the ballpark, during the building of the ballpark, we had to be very clear. Jeffrey, I want to give him a credit where credit's due in terms of the look of the ballpark. He is extremely talented at making things look good. But when it comes to the actual practical construction of something, that was not his strength.
Well, he took all the credit for writing it on a napkin, right? As if that's how it got built.
Yeah. So when the construction's going on, there are moments when he wants something done and it simply couldn't be done. And I would have to say to him, we're not doing this. And he would say, if you don't do this, you're not going to be a part of this and we're not going to go forward. So there were many moments like that with certain players where he would say, if we don't sign this guy, then I don't want to own this team and you're all going to lose your jobs. So like Jared Saltalamacchia is an example where we're told we have to sign him because if we don't have Saltalamacchia catching for us, I'd rather not on the team. That was sort of his go-to line, which I never understood because it was very silly. But the funny part is he was getting it from people who he had hired as scouts in the organization who were taking advantage of him, really. That's the sad part.
Do you have very many good Hideki Arabu stories? Because you mentioned his name, and I don't know. He was haunted a little bit. He had some darkness, some culture shock. I remember.
He committed suicide.
Okay. I'm sorry.
He's dead. So he does have a lot. He did have a lot of ghosts, and he was a very sad man. I don't think that people realize what Steinbrenner did to him, and I was able to speak to him about that. Remember back in the day where he was called the Fat Toad? I'm sure you guys don't remember that.
No, I
do. No, I remember. I remember the tabloids. I remember the culture shock. If you hadn't jarred me with the he committed suicide, I was headed down a path to talk about how New York devoured him. How New York devoured a guy who came from a very different culture that couldn't possibly understand the cruelty of New York.
That's 100% what it was. And he was an emotional wreck. We had no idea when we traded for him. We knew that he'd been called the Fat Toad, but we didn't know that he had been. And it's a cautionary tale, Mikey, like about James Harden. You don't know a player till you live with that player. You can talk to people who know him, but you don't know. We didn't realize that Hideki had been so deleteriously impacted by what George Steinbrenner said that there was no coming back. Literally, not in baseball and not in life. He was a chain smoker. He would smoke in between innings while he was pitching. We had to put him to sleep to fly because he couldn't go hours without smoking. And so we took drugs to fly, and we'd wake him, and we'd let him have a cigarette before boarding the plane. Then we'd give him drugs. He'd sleep, and then he'd have a cigarette before the team bus could leave. That was something because of that addiction. But he was a loner, miserable, sad, angry. He went from a deer in headlights when he got to New York to a person who just assumed that everybody was out to devour him and hate him, and it impacted his ability to pitch.
Well, I had a plan non sequitur when it comes to a pitcher that dealt with addiction, but it actually bridges a little bit there. I've been wanting to ask you about Jeff Allison for the longest time, because I was kind of thinking about him when we were talking about the Tyler Hero Stanton scenario. You have this surefire generation, once in a generation prospect.
And that was heroin addiction, correct?
Jeff Allison, for those that don't know, had a really bad heroin addiction. And while Josh Hamilton was getting all the headlines because he actually came out of it and had a good pro career, Jeff Allison just couldn't make it. What can you tell us about Jeff Allison, his struggles with addiction, and your struggles as a front office in trying to get him right?
So this is an interesting one because I had to be a hardline business guy and not pay him. And it was a major problem because his doctors, his psychologists, his psychiatrists, his rehab people thought that I was being, that I was wrong for taking away his bonus. But he did not fulfill the obligations of his contract and I could not reward that behavior. On the other hand, we helped him get help. So Jeffrey took on the role with Jeff Allison, which is very rare. Here's an example of something Jeffrey did that people wouldn't talk about. This is a drafted kid who was an abject disaster in terms of on field, never made it. And Jeffrey helped him for years after he didn't make it in terms of getting him the help that he needed. We drafted him and our head scouts thought that he had a chance. He was from the Boston area, that he could be like a Josh Beckett, basically. And we were aware that there were some issues. The issues we were told is hardline neighborhood. The issues were sometimes in the wrong crowd. The issues are an occasional dabble. And again, I would use my own personal experience. I've never done anything with needles, but I've done whatever. I've gotten stoned. So to me, doing drugs or getting high or drinking is not going to stop you from being successful. I was not aware that he was shooting up heroin. When it became obvious, because we were told, and I remember the phone call from our team psychologist who could not disclose anything that had been told during sessions, but was able to say, hey, we're going to have a positive drug test here. And Jeff Allison never was able to shake the addiction until his arm disappeared. For whatever reason, it wasn't steroids. He was able to throw 94, 95, 96 back then when that mattered. And then without drugs, he couldn't pitch anymore. It was very bizarre because they were not PEDs. And he's got his life together, but he has no money. So, and I've been called about Jeff Allison as recently as 2 years ago to see if I could help him get work with a team, if I could help him get money because he has no money. And he had a decent sized bonus that I didn't pay because of what he did. So that type of addiction, it's not like the Tyler Skaggs situation, where it becomes something that you've made it to the major leagues and it gets dealt by actually someone in your clubhouse. And this was an example of a kid who, when he went home, was just around people who did drugs with him. It's one of the saddest stories of any draft pick, actually.
Jeffrey was pretty caring when he formed attachments with players, and he did it often, did he not?
It was strange. He liked being a father figure to them. He liked taking care of them. He liked being the ones to call draft picks when they got drafted. He liked being the ones to call players when they were making the All-Star team for the first time or making a team for the first time. The first time JT Realmuto got called up, he got told by Jeffrey, right? The first time Stan got called up, he got told by Jeffrey. Jeffrey wanted to be on the phone for those things because he liked being the good news guy. Right. He never sent anyone down. He never traded anyone. He never fired anyone. That's what we did. And I don't, you know, Jose Fernandez is when he made the All-Star team. He's the one who arranged to get Jose's grandmother here from Cuba.
Yeah.
He did that.
Yes.
I mean, that was, if you ask the people in Miami who worked politically to get it done, it was all because Jeffrey wanted to get it done. I couldn't have cared less about that. And he did. So that is the enigma of Jeffrey. Is that as meddlesome and horrific it was for on-field performance 95% of the time, players, for the most part, liked him because of what he did personally for them.
Who was he closest to? Was it Hanley? Was it someone else? The guy that he befriended, right? Because Arthur Blank got in some trouble for this. He befriended Michael Vick, and it ended up blowing up in his face. And I remember it was a necklace, right? Or a charm that goes on a necklace that was given to Hanley by Jeffrey Lurie. And I know you guys have talked about this, but which one is the guy that he became most close to?
As a father figure, he was closest to Jose, which is why he was so devastated when Jose died and why to this day he'll tell you that the toxicology reports are wrong because no father ever wants to believe that their child can make a mistake. So he is like the family lawyer saying that there's a conspiracy and that it's just not the case. But he would always choose the players who we would have a hard time with, like a Hanley Ramirez, who we had to discipline, because then Jeffrey could come off as being the good guy, where I'm not going to discipline you. I'm going to say that you're right and I love your talent. He viewed, you have to understand his background. He's an art dealer. He spent his life knowing Picasso, Henry Moore, Roy Lichtenstein, Larry Rivers, all sorts of pop artists and all sorts of real amazing artists. And he knew that they're a little off, and that's what makes them so great in their art. He viewed players as artists.
Now, I don't know much about your upbringing with Jeffrey as a stepfather, although, very bizarre that he wouldn't apologize and he would just, like, emotionally fire you and then you would show up to work the next day. Oh, you have something here?
Yeah, when you say emotionally fire me, he didn't take away my badge. Mm-hmm. It was, you better do this. Like Lebatard was a good example. He said, if you want to work here, you will not go on Lebatard's show again because I've got people listening. So if you go on his show next week, that will be your last day. I think that is that firing? I think that's just threatening.
No, it's threatening, but it does speak to your dynamic. And I'm not trying to put you on the couch here. I'm saying this as someone with my own daddy issues, with my own stepdaddy issues. When you say he's like a father to like Hanley Ramirez and to Jose Fernandez, and if I can make a movie analogy, is it part like, are you like Edward Norton looking at Brad Pitt take Jared Leto under his arm, and then all of a sudden the jealousy starts flowing through you, and then you just want to beat the shit out of Jared Leto because you, quote, wanted to destroy something beautiful?
I never wanted to do anything physically to anyone because I'm 5'5", 125.
I probably took it to the extreme with the Fight Club analogy.
Well, you also really put him on the couch. You said you didn't want to put him on the couch, and you made him think about something that he's never thought about before.
That's not true.
It sounds like he's thought about it.
Okay, so you've thought about it, but you don't know how to phrase it. You usually know. Look, the thing that I'm surprised by is you're never speechless. You could bullshit your way through anything. So you do not have those moments of like, what do I want to say here? I need to be super careful. Let me show everyone that I'm being super careful.
Cutting right to it is David Samson.
You guys are different, right? Okay, I do your show differently than I do other shows because you know more. You guys know me more. And I let your audience in on things that I really don't do anywhere else. So you're asking me a question about a family dynamic that is complicated to a point that I can't even begin to describe to you.
Okay. I was just trying to cut to it. When you see like Jeffrey be a father to Jose Fernandez, are you like, why aren't you that kind of father to me?
No, that's not what it's like.
Okay, then please explain.
No, because that's not, because I'm a father to three. And I'm a mediocre father at best. I'm somewhere on the between poor and mediocre in terms of what the kids need versus what I can give. And that's always been the disconnect, is that I think I'm giving all I can give and what I can give. And their view is whatever you're giving is not what we want. If you could just give the other stuff, that's what we'd want. And I can't do it. I was always very aware as a kid what my father and stepfather and mother could give, and I never wanted anything else, which is why that informs why I'm so hurt by the relationship with my kids, who view me as so inadequate in so many ways. But I don't know why we're even talking about this. Is this going to be recorded? I mean, are you releasing this?
I'm releasing this.
So whatever.
Mike was headed to a sensitive, vulnerable place with you, and you put your mask back on.
Yeah.
So I have to on this, right? Because you're asking me a question about dealing with working with family. Do you have any experience working with a father figure?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. Okay. So if you ever had worked with your dad, my guess is there were moments where you had a frustration level with him as a dad, and you had to separate yourself from being the son, and it caused inner torment.
He never looked at me like the boss, and I'm remembering as you bring this up, because you're bringing back a haunting, haunting image to me, because I remember slamming one of the cold metallic doors here in his face because he had enraged me so much because he would not treat me like any kind of authority figure. He was always treating me like his little kid again and again. Never mind boss. I wasn't looking for boss. Just how about like you treat any other coworker? But it can never be that.
It can never be that. So I was treated by Jeffrey in some ways better than anyone and in some ways worse than anyone. And that is what father figures do, right? And all I wanted to do was please him. But there were moments when I knew I couldn't please him because I had to do something that he didn't want me to do that I knew was in his best interest in the long term. The moment when the son becomes the father and the father-son relationship is a very difficult moment for both the son and the father. And it happens all the time as fathers get older.
Give me the example, though. Give us the example of the time where you ran across it that way, where it became a conflict that you're like, man, this is what's complicated about making family and business. And everyone advises you, David. Everyone will advise you. Do not mix family and business.
So what I did is, because you're right.
Which is why I've never worked with my family on anything. It's why I refuse to work with family. Every turn, I will not work with my family.
Yeah, you never have. I can't imagine. You obviously would never want to work with anyone in your family because it would cause great angst for someone like you. And you, angst is not your gas. Angst is your kryptonite. So, of course, you're smart enough not to do that. But for me, I never had that level of emotional intelligence. So when I had the opportunity to work with my family, I said yes. And I grew up with a father, by the way. My father worked in a family business with his father, my grandfather. And I saw firsthand how bad that was. And therefore, when I started working with Jeffrey, I made it very clear, I'm your team president. Please treat me like a team president. If I'm not doing well for you, let me go. If I'm doing well for you, give me a raise. But don't pull the father card. And there were times that he did. And the times that he did were both family related, when there were family issues going on and he asked me to take care of them. And he asked me to do it as a president and as a son. And there were times on the field when he would say, David, you're going to have to deal with this issue because I want to hire Joe Girardi. And I know that Larry Beinfest does not want Joe Girardi. And I don't want to hear it from Larry. So you're going to go talk to Larry and you're going to tell Larry that we're bringing in Girardi. And he's going to smile. He's going to like it. And that's it. And then I had to go to Jeffrey when Girardi was hired the day of the press conference. And I had to say, Jeffrey, we're going to fire this guy. This guy will be the worst manager we've ever had. I guarantee it. And Jeffrey said, you do your job and I'll do mine. And by the way, the rest is history with Girardi.
How did you know?
Manager of the year.
How did you know that? How did you know that quickly that that you're telling him at the introductory press conference, we're going to fire this guy. It's going to be a bad relationship. Like, it's odd to know it that quickly, David. I know you've covered some of this ground, but that fast is crazy.
No, I've not told you why. I've never said why. And I guess I've never said why. Because Joe, but screw it. You know what? I don't even care. Joe Girardi demanded that we hire his guys. Bobby Meacham, a guy named Harkey, and a guy named Gary Tuck. That if we were hiring Girardi as manager, he would not do it without these guys. And he said, here's what you're going to pay them. And here's their jobs. And we said to Jeffrey, we're not hiring these guys. It's ridiculous. You can give him a bench coach, but not that guy. We'll get an experienced bench coach, like a Bob Melvin type bench coach, someone who'd been in the game a long time, a Riggleman type bench coach to work with him. But that's it. So Joe Girardi, we go to the press conference because we had no choice but to take these guys, because Jeffrey went into me and Larry and said, we are bringing in Meacham is the infield guy and Harkey is the bullpen guy and Tuck is the catching bench coach. Who knows? And by the way, these guys were just bad. So cut to the press conference. We introduce him and Joe Girardi gets off the stage. The first thing he does is he brings his son with him, Dante, who's now like college age. And he's doing the press conference with his kids running around like banshees. They were little kids. We were like, get out of here. Like, this is a professional press conference. There's no reason to have your kid like with you at the dais. It was so ridiculous. But then it got worse. The press conference ends. Joe Girardi comes right up to me and Larry and says, hey, is the deal done yet with Meacham and Harkey? And we said, Joe, do you understand that they work for the Yankees and we have to get permission for Meacham before? I don't care. Don't tell me what it is. You get it done right now or I'm walking. That's what Joe Girardi's threatening me and Larry the day he's hired, that he's going to quit and dropping on us that, by the way, you know, I'm Jeffrey's guy. So all I have to do is go to Jeffrey and anything I want, I get. And that made my head explode. And that was the last time I was willing to ever want to work with Joe Girardi, be a part of Joe Girardi. And during the course of the season, it got worse and worse when he, as a first-time manager, pretended he would come up to me, by the way, on a side note, I don't like this ticket plan. I don't like this marketing. By the way, that in-game video, that's not a good in-game video. And I would be like, you know what, Joe? Could you just manage the team?
Did you enjoy firing him?
You have no idea. You have no idea how much.
Well, I mean, you sound angry, and I rarely hear that out of you. Like, you sound
because he
like
had a sense of entitlement. He, you know, he was a first-time manager that didn't even have to be interviewed because Jeffrey was just hiring him. And so he came into the interview, and he knew and we didn't. He knew that he was being hired, and we were interviewing him as though we were interviewing him.
Can you take us into the room when you fired him?
Joe, you're fired.
Just like that, you turn your back, you don't wait for his response?
Couldn't have cared less. Literally couldn't have cared less.
Well,
literally.
Before we get into your review of the week, I've done some Googling. This James Patterson, quite the career. He's having a moment right now with this John Lennon book.
Did you ask Dan? Hey, Dan, I don't know if you were here in the beginning. Who's more famous, James Patterson or James Harden?
Well, but you're assuming that we're talking about writing in the modern age where publishing is dying and everything is dying. And James Harden looks unique. And if Patterson walked into most rooms, people wouldn't know who he is. So
I'm not talking about his face.
I could
I'm
wake up next name. To James Patterson and have no idea.
I have.
You're missing the question. One more time. The name recognition, not face. Name.
I don't know if it's fair to ask a writer that, though. I don't know that a writer is going to think of authors. I don't know where I'd put James Patterson in the pantheon of famous writers of our time. Where would you put him in terms of just fame? Or output?
In terms of prolific, well, output, he's way up there. I mean, in terms of prolific, you'd have to put a prolific next to his name. No, Mikey,
I just think
James Patterson can leave his house, go to his favorite coffee shop, and not be bothered. That can never happen to James
the
Harden
other thing,
in any part of
the
world.
The other thing, Dave, you're talking, this is very much, okay, this is two separate worlds, because while there is wealth and educated in sports, you can also reach uneducated in sports with your fame. It's really hard to do that.
Don't do that. Don't make me feel stupid for thinking James Harden is more famous. You hoity-toity writers.
I'm doing it the other way.
James Harden has a candy.
You're
guys.
So uneducated, you don't even understand the point I'm making. I'm telling you that poor people know who James Harden is, and uneducated people might not know who James Patterson is.
Oh, so no, I actually did know the point that you're making, and it sounds just as awful. I'm not stupid for thinking James Harden is more famous than James Patterson.
Had you heard of James Patterson, Mikey?
Of course I didn't.
You had not?
No, but oh I've seen God, the John James Lennon book. Right. I saw the John Lennon book is a thing. You know, everyone's talking about it on GMA. I walked past an airport bookstore, and I was like, that looks interesting. The Final Days of John Lennon. And then I
Who's
Googled it, and
famous?
I'm like, I've seen some of these movies.
John Grisham or John Starks?
Okay, but you just did something where you took a more famous author that was more famous than the basketball player.
Yeah,
you're
but
choosing.
At the same time, if I wake up next to John Grisham, I'm not going to know it's John Grisham. I'm going to know it's John Starks.
It's very funny the way you're talking, because I think that we get caught up here in the sports world as thinking that what we do, and you guys don't. The irony is your show is the opposite. Your show, the point of your show is the ridiculousness of the fact that people know who James Harden is.
Names recognition is certainly a part of this, but face recognition is also. I don't know what barely any writer looks like that is a famous author. I know what Stephen King looks like. If I saw Stephen King walking down the sidewalk, I'd be like,
yeah,
wow.
But he's not doing at all. He's doing name. Fame of name is
correct.
All he's doing, because he's not doing recognizable. Because
okay. Grisham, I'll give you over Starks, but I'm not giving you Patterson over Harden. I refuse.
Okay.
What are you reviewing?
I'm reviewing a documentary about the Bee Gees. I watched it at your suggestion.
Dude, I've amazing things. I need to see this thing.
You,
tell me about it.
First of all, I grew up during this time. I had no idea that they were such prolific songwriters. I had no idea. All you know about the Bee Gees for me
is crap. It's disco crap. It's
come on.
They started the disco movement. And this documentary goes through their rise and goes through the tragic deaths of all of them. I remember Andy Gibb as the teen idol because, to me, Andy Gibb was the guy who was able, much more so than the actual Bee Gees. I thought Andy Gibb was one of the original Bee Gees. Until this movie, I thought Andy Gibb was one of the three Bee Gees. And I didn't realize he's the fourth younger brother by a lot. I also didn't know that Maurice and Robin are twins. Totally missed that. I also didn't know Barry Gibb lives in Miami and is the only one still alive. Didn't know that. So it goes on and on of epiphanies about the Bee Gees and the music that they did and the fame that they had, sort of like the Sean Cassidy type fame is what I thought it was. I don't know if you know that name.
I do. That's got a Partridge Family feel, does it not? That's a link there.
I thought that that sort of teen bop fame, like Leif Garrett. I thought the Bee Gees were like a Leif Garrett or the people who had that crazy.
Well, they were sensual because they had the big shoes and the shirts that revealed heavy, heavy chest hair because the buttons would be down to the navel and the feathered hair, even from the balding guy, which is a bad look.
They had the Farrah Fawcett feathered hair made famous by Farrah Fawcett. That's who originally did it. And every man back then in the 70s was trying to look like Farrah Fawcett, ironically, which is funny how life is in the 2020s. But in any case, so this documentary is extremely well done. It's directed by a great director whose name is Frank Marshall, who I believe directed one of my favorite movies called Alive, but I may be confusing the Marshalls.
Love that movie.
It's amazing. How about John Malkovich at the end?
Are you talking about the survival movie?
No, you guys yes. are. Wait a minute. You guys yes. talking about the cannibalism?
Yes. That's the movie. It's called Alive. It's about the soccer team who crashes in the Andes and they have to eat each other. And then John Malkovich at the end of the movie plays them as older guys, as an older now. And he's smoking a cigarette and he looks in the camera and he says something like, "You don't know what you would do in a situation for all of you judging what I did. You don't know what you would do until you're in that situation." Very powerful movie, by the way. And I have no idea why we're talking about Alive. Oh, Frank Marshall, because I think the guy who directed the Bee Gees movie directed Alive, but I could be totally wrong. But if you're looking for a documentary.
Two very different movies.
Very different. And we've talked about.
Well, they're about staying alive.
I can't find the Metallica documentary, you guys.
That's a good joke.
I know. You told me to watch it. I can't find it.
No, but that's a good documentary. But that was a good joke. He just did a Staying Alive Bee Gees joke that you weren't listening to that was really well done.
You got to explain it.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Go ahead. Okay. The Metallica documentary was on Netflix. I don't know where it went.
It's not.
Oh, you should download this app called Just Watch, David. You just put in any movie and it'll tell you exactly what streaming platform. That's a life hack for everybody. Just watch.
That's good. What do you feel about people stealing movies on the internet? Are you willing to watch a movie for free? I watched a movie last night. I paid $18.99 for it, and I'm so angry. It was called Freaky.
See that with Vince Vaughn. By the way, you can rent Metallica's Some Kind of Monster on Apple TV for $3.99.
Why would you guys watch that? I saw the other day the preview, and I'm like, why is Vince Vaughn in this movie? And then I look at the date, and it says 2020. I'm like, this is a new movie. Why did Vince Vaughn make this choice?
It looks like a fun popcorn flick.
It's cha-ching. First of all, I didn't realize it was a horror movie, and I don't watch horror movies. But once I started it, I was stuck because I don't stop watching movies, even if I don't like them. So I had to watch the rest of it, but I watched the majority of it, you know, with my hand over my face.
Premise seems funny. It's like a Freaky Friday, only like a girl and a serial killer change bodies.
Except they try to make it scary. And so I was scared for a lot of the movie. And it is a ridiculous change of body movie. I'm not reviewing it yet. Actually, I could. Vince Vaughn. What's happening? He needed a paycheck. I felt like it was a paycheck movie, and I know he felt the same. He felt like he was broadening his acting chops by playing a girl with a man's body and the usual jokes. Oh, my God, I've got balls. Oh, my God, my hand is so big. Oh, my God, I run like a girl now. So he got to flex his physical comedy muscles a little bit, but it was so disingenuous that I kept longing for the days of Wedding Crashers and Old School and other such great Vince Vaughn vehicles, even Prisoner on Block 89, where he tries to
be serious
and is.
That was good. That was a good movie.
Phenomenal movie. But this movie, it's just absolute crap. But Bee Gees was good, so I went one for two. But the point is I paid $18.99 to watch Freaky. Would you go to a website that would show you a movie for free if you know that you're stealing that movie and the quality is not HD? Would you do that?
I've done that in the past and I stopped.
Yeah, I won't do it. I feel it's
just the quality suffers so much, man.
Oh, that's not the reason for me. The reason for me is people. It's the reason I watch the credits of every movie. There's people who work hard to entertain me, and I want to make sure that they get paid, and I want to make sure that I wait and watch their names. It always bothered me as a kid when you watched movies on regular channels. And have you ever seen this where they increase the speed of the credits at the end so they can get to the next movie? And imagine being one of those people.
We should have talked with David. We're out of time here, but just real quick, what do you make of the directors all around Hollywood? Nolan, the guy who did Dune, I don't know what his name is, complaining about their movies going straight to HBO Max during a pandemic.
Yeah, they're the people who still want to use a typewriter. So either get on the boat or miss
it. Don't you romanticize the cinema? I feel like Dan was far too dismissive of these guys.
I'm surprised that's David. David does create a mythology around the big screen. I would think that you would want the artist to get the maximum of the artist experience, the artist glory.
But the most of the movies that you watch aren't in a theater. They're in your home. So I romanticize. Like the only thing that like I really bonded with my dad over was wrestling and going to the movies. Going to the movies was such an amazing, magical experience. So I get why these people that have practiced their whole lives, gone to school, trained, shot movies and worked their way up, want to see their vision on the big screen the way that they did when they were a child.
But this is back when TVs were 12-inch TVs in black and white, right? That's not even the very cheap TVs now are smart TVs and big screens. It's very different now. Did you ever go to movies alone?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, there's two types of people, right? People who would go to a movie alone and people who wouldn't. So I would go to movies alone as well. And I'm just as happy to be alone in my apartment or house watching a movie as I am to go to a theater. And I think that what Christopher Nolan's missing is that Warner Brothers pays him, right? He makes his money. And if they don't make money, it's like players not wanting owners to make money.
I just like the procedure of going to a movie theater. It makes me be better. If I'm at home, I can't keep my phone away from me. Work distracts me. Something is always distracting me. Where the pomp and circumstance of going to a movie theater makes me really delve into the feature. And if Christopher Nolan says the best way to watch Tenet is on the big screen, I'm going to trust Christopher Nolan.
So are you going to watch it for $18.99? Because I was going to do that last night too, and I'm going to do that this week.
Tenet was mad disappointing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man.
That's disappointing because I have to watch it. I mean, I'll watch any movie. There are not many directors who I will watch the movie no matter what, even if it gets panned.
I'll tell you what made Tenet better after watching it, because I didn't know what the hell I watched. And then I just started going to Reddit and started seeing theories. There is a theory about the end of the movie that, if it is indeed the truth, makes me be like, okay, that wasn't a total waste of time. But I'll get with you after you watch Tenet. You should, because right, Christopher Nolan's one of these must-see directors.
And I'm going to pay the $18.
Do it in 4K.
I don't. By the way, I'm given that option for freaky, and there's so many options. I don't know which one to choose, so I choose the most expensive one, thinking it's got to be the best.
You have to see freaky in 4K. It's important.
We'll talk to you next week, David.
See you later, guys.
Actually, no, we won't. It's the holidays. We'll circle back.
Happy Chinooka!
Thank you, Smokey.